Does losing Kyiv mean that Ukrainians have lost their country? What then?
Yeah, a very good question. I don't know. There are lots of assessments. I don't think it means losing the country because, frankly, there are rumors that he wants to bring back Yanukovych, who was actually chased out of the country back in 2014. I don't think another government would survive more than 2 minutes because the Ukrainians wouldn't want it. They wouldn't accept it. I think what would probably then happen is they would be mired in a long-term struggle or war of attrition with the government. I mean, it's a country of 40 million. Chechnya, even Georgia, are smaller countries with, you know, just several million in population. Kyiv alone has 3 million people. You can't even control Kyiv itself. Putin and his core misjudged the feeling of the Ukrainian people. They just simply are fed up. This isn't Ukraine of 1991, 92, or 93. They are definitely, you know, they have no visa regime to travel to Europe. So Ukrainians have been traveling to Europe like EU citizens. They've seen what it's like. They've lived and worked there. They send money back. And that's changed their look. And I think Putin is not aware of that. He thinks, you know, it's still sort of that isolationist period. And I think if Kyiv were to fall, I have friends who are still there. I'm really worried about them because they said, Paul, we're not leaving. This is our country. It's our capital. We're going to defend it. I think it would fall, but you would probably end up with having a war of attrition. What I'm sort of worried about is a situation like the Spanish Civil War, you know, fascists versus the communists. Here it'd be the people who are for freedom and liberty and democracy versus the autocrats. And then, you know, people would come, whether there's already rumors of Polish, former service members, British, Irish, even Americans, that they were going in there to support the Ukrainians. You know, it can develop into a more protracted struggle. I think what will happen is Putin may, if he's not successful here, and I don't really think he will be, but who knows, is what he's going to try to do is create a stalemate and then leave some forces behind somewhere where he can always, you know, end up causing some trouble. That's what I think may be his best end game at this point.
With Ukrainian President Zelensky's enormous presence on social media, mm-hmm. And his constant contact with British Parliament, President Biden, governments all over Europe. In the bits and clips from the front lines, there have been Ukrainians putting TikToks up, even Russian soldiers putting TikToks up. And in the media's, the mainstream media's keen attention. Between all of that, what pieces do you feel are missing that you're aware of?
Oh, that are missing in that. I think what really needs to hold together here is the unity of the coalition against Putin. It's the sanctions that if things happen or some negotiations that everybody stands fast and doesn't decide, well, it's over now. I think we punished him while his troops still remain in Ukraine. I think also what's missing in a bigger picture, and then I'll maybe go down to, you know, sort of what individual levels, is the United Nations. I mean, I thought it's supposed to be an organization that supports peace and humanitarianism. And, you know, with UNICEF, there's no word about the United Nations doing anything and not even asking for any humanitarian corridors or anything like that. So that's, I think, missing. And frankly, in my opinion, that could be the, I don't know, it's going to not look very good for the United Nations when it was organized after World War II. I mean, to prevent these kinds of things from happening. And frankly, they're happening and they're powerless to do anything about it. On a more local level, you know, in terms of TikTok and those messages, I think that is key now. What is forming is a battle, is a information warfare space. We use it a lot in terms of cyber and attacks and hacking. But now this is a real war for the hearts and minds. We've had Ukrainian relatives who talk to their Russian relatives who live in Russia and explain what's happening, and their relatives in Russia simply do not believe them that there's a war and that buildings are getting bombed. They simply do not believe it because it's their media is tightly controlled. So the big piece of that with this TikTok and all these different social media sites, a lot of which have been clamped down but not completely, is for people in the West to keep sending things to Russia to let the people know so that word comes out, you know, whether it's text messaging. You know, we're at one initiative now by the Ukrainians, and I think it's with the West. Is there 3 million, at least 3 million diaspora Russians living in Europe, and probably even some in the United States? If all of them could send text messages to their relatives to show them what's going on or explain it, that's very hard for the Russians to censor all communications like that. So that's a big piece. I think Anonymous has been very active in taking down and defacing some Russian websites and putting on content that shows what's really happening. The Russians are very cynical people, though. They've been lied to for so long, and they've been listening to propaganda channels that they simply refuse to believe that. But I think the one crucial difference here is, in many ways, the Russians wouldn't react and say, well, we just don't believe anybody. What they will have to put two and two together for reasonable people is all the difficult sanctions that are now being imposed on them. And not just on the oligarchs, because they can say, well, we don't care if the oligarch can't sail his yacht. You know, we just care if we can find bread or food for the table. Well, they're now getting hit. You know, MasterCard and Visa cutting back, you know, shutting services. The banks are closed. So now the actual middle class, and even, you know, all Russians are now starting to feel the pain. And I think we'll start asking questions. Why is this happening now? It never happened before. So that's, I think this ultimately will be won. And the idea then would be regime change in Moscow. And, you know, that can happen probably not very soon, but eventually that's the only way I think this war in Ukraine will end.
I want to circle back around to what we can do to help.
Well, I think at least initially now is, you know, sending some of this assistance. And again, I can provide the website for the people we work with. But, you know, things like, you know, baby food, diapers, blankets, you know, medicine are useful. And then we're getting lists. I mean, it's all just starting to develop. As a matter of fact, the refugee centers in Poland opened up a little bit later because they didn't anticipate the outpouring of sympathy from the Polish population that took in the initial refugees going to the town squares, to the railway stations, and saying, I have room for two people, I have room for four people, and taking them into their homes, their apartments. Now it's starting to develop into a much bigger crisis. They're over, like I said, 1.5 million, they're expecting 2 million. So the idea is, again, you know, funding some of these organizations. And I think as things get settled now, what we're working on, I mean, you raised a very good point, is the children who are out. I mean, there are some orphans, but the idea is maybe, you know, have them become pen pals with people here, or, you know, write to, you know, develop some relationships with, you know, students here, write back and forth in that sense to keep their spirits up. Right now, it's just basically survival because these people are trying to get across the border, or ultimately they may end up on the western side of the border, on the Ukrainian side of the border. So basically, they need the elements to just stay alive. And then after that, you know, there'll be other things that we can then pose. There probably will be some requests for, you know, I think President Biden said that the U.S. will accept some of these refugees. They may travel here. You know, that's another commitment, but people may want to maybe host some families. I know there are huge populations of Ukrainian sort of diaspora in like New York, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Washington, Chicago, San Francisco. So, you know, some of those people will take in, but that will be later on the road. Right now, I think it's a question of survival and helping people get out. So if anybody has information about people to assist with that sort of thing, that would be, you know, very, very welcome. A lot of Ukrainians now, the new generation, do speak English, that they study English as a second language. So it's not what it would have been even 20, 30 years ago. You know, the financial part would be the best. We have a lot of people on the ground in Poland and Ukraine that they can use those resources very quickly. And they were formed to help in this crisis period before it becomes a more monolithic sort of movement and, you know, and sort of bureaucratic in a way. It's Help Ukraine 22. And what it is just very briefly a couple words about that. It was set up, and I've known this friend. I mean, I've known him for 12 years now. He's a very active member, one of the most influential expats in Kyiv. He set up the Committee for Open Democracy. And this group now, he set up this crisis intervention fund immediately. It's a 501c3, which means it's tax deductible, any contributions, to immediately impact and help the people on the ground in Ukraine. He's been very active in getting families out, providing financial support, also providing food and water to these areas, you know, in a mass, by getting, you know, minivans and trucks to deliver as much as they can. In other words, being very active in a short period of time and not waiting for a big bureaucracy to kick in. This is very critical for, you know, Mariupol is a war zone. I mean, literally. And what we've encountered now is that some of the families just don't want to leave. We're trying to get a family out of Cherkasy now, and it was Vinnytsia the other day in Odessa. When we actually say we have a team ready, they'll come tomorrow morning, they'll pick you up in a truck or a car rather, and take you to the border, they don't want to go. They said, we're done. I mean, they're fearful of the, but the roads in Western Ukraine are relatively okay, but they're sort of fearful of getting outside these bomb shelters. And number two, they just feel like if they leave, they may never, ever come back. And it's a traumatic emotional experience for them to make that decision, especially if they have young sons. I think, I mean, my family's exactly in that boat. My cousin, he's in her early 60s. Her son is around 30 something, and he's married and he has two children. So if the women all go across, he has to stay behind, and they don't know if they'll see him again. Is he going to draft it? Will he go to war? Will he survive? I mean, these are difficult, difficult emotional stresses for all of them and decisions. So, you know, I can't argue. If they say they change their mind at the last minute, you know, I say, look, it's your choice. You know, we'll do what we can, but I understand. I mean, I hate to be in that same position, having to make those decisions. I have a very good friend who just said a couple of them left, but they're doing some very interesting work for helping out the Ukrainian government. They're cyber specialists. They finally moved to Lviv a couple of days ago, within the last 24 hours, and their equipment, because you certainly don't want the Russians getting this stuff. But the other fellow stayed behind. He goes, Paul, I'm not leaving. This is my city, my capital. I'll die here if I have to. And that's not a decision most people don't have to make. And, you know, that's the way they feel about it. That's why I think the Russians will not hold Ukraine. They can create a mess. And then the question, I mean, they'll want a chaos, but they won't hold any of those cities. They won't even hold Kyiv. But the bottom line is, what will the international community do? Will they say, I want to go back to watching TV, lower gas prices, and I'm not committed to this? Or will they stay together? Because if the Western community stays together, Putin's losing, and they will force Russia to finally become a civilized member, I think, eventually, or be destroyed in the process. A lot of people have written books about the fact that Russia may not exist after this, because it's a small country. Siberia is actually part of China. If you notice now, the Japanese foreign minister, I think yesterday, but within the last few days, made much stronger comments about getting the Kuril Islands back. That's the ones that the Russians took over after World War II that the Japanese have never gotten over. I think people are going to look at dismembering Russia and taking what's theirs. Interesting, and another sidelight, I mean, it's neither here nor there. Hotels in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan are chock full of people, because outside there's no way to get to Europe now without going through Ukraine. Everything else is blocked off. They have to go through Helsinki by train. But if you live in Central Asia or somewhere, you're far, I mean, or even outside of Leningrad, it's a long way. Everybody is using corridors to Central Asia because they can get out there. China Airlines still flies in, but they may stop too, because frankly, the sanctions will affect anybody doing business. So even though the Chinese may not care what the U.S. says, but then Chinese goods will be sanctioned because they're doing business with Russia. So, but the people are now in Central Asia trying to get out to Asia. That's the only way to get out of Russia right now.
So, I also wanted to ask you, in a letter to the editor, you referenced Guns of August.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes me wonder, do you think the world's string of alliances will pull the globe into all-out war?
I think Putin definitely will go. It would then increase his. He'd go into Georgia, Poland, and the Baltics. Would the Iranians feel emboldened to go after Israel right now? Would North Korea feel emboldened to go after South Korea? You know, there's two ways to look at it. One, that's why it's important, not so much what happens right now, but that Russia is resisted, because what Russia is trying to do is change the world, the post-World War II order, the world order. If they do that, then all of that is on the table, and that's just going to be a conflict after conflict. If the West, I mean by we the West, hold forward against Russia, then it's less likely that these other things will become a problem. But, you know, exactly, China is looking at this now and saying, whoa, this is pretty messy right now. Do we want to do this with Taiwan? I think they would have a slower approach, and I don't think they would try to militarily take it over, because they see what's happening when the population doesn't like you. You really, this one person you ought to follow if you want to see what's going on in Russia, Ukraine. His name is Christo. What he said was he thinks that they would not use a nuclear tactical nuke on Ukraine, because frankly, it would contaminate their troops. They'd have a hard time being there. But he thinks it very easily, not easily, but could be contemplated to be used against Poland. Because if Poland is acting as a support structure for all the arms and weapons coming in, soldiers, they're actually dealing with all the refugees. And the Poles and Russians for centuries don't like each other. So this one individual said, if it happens, if there's a nuclear strike, he could see them taking a shot at Poland. But then that invokes Article 5. And then what do you do? To prevent that Guns of August scenario, like sleepwalking into World War, the U.S. and the West have to be very firm in their resolve on these sanctions and take nothing less than complete withdrawal of Russian troops to pre the February 24th borders, or, you know, even before Donbass. If that doesn't happen, then yep, it will all break loose into fights all around the world at that point.
So it's up to us, not up to Russia.
Yep, exactly. I think it is, you know, and if some of these steps were taken, and I realize Biden had a difficult job, I think he's done fairly well. I mean, there are certain things. I mean, the no-fly zone, I think that's, you know, it sounds nice, but it means developing a good defense system for Ukraine. And I think ultimately they could get Patriots, I think, you know, for cruise missiles. They've actually done a fairly decent job. They'd be more of, you know, shooting down a lot of the cruise missiles, because, you know, they're very slow moving targets. And if you pick that up, you can actually take it out of the sky. So developing that, and I think they'll work. They're very, you know, what they're looking at now, and that's just, I mean, I've been discussing that with them. I know some in Turkey, there's an S-400. It's the most modern anti-aircraft missile system that the Russians sold to the Turks, which caused the U.S. and NATO a huge angst, because how can you have a NATO member buying Russian military equipment? So after a significant amount of pressure, the Turks put it in storage. So I think what the Ukrainians are trying to do is getting the Turks to ship it to them now, and they'll even pay for it. That would be great. That would be ideal. I told the Ukrainians, I talked to some officials, I said, no, just harp on getting the most and the best anti-aircraft protection you can get. That kind of thing, or anti-missile and that. So, I mean, I think they've learned that. They've used drones very, very effectively there. Boy, what their techniques that they're using are going to be taught at war colleges in the U.S. for many years to come here in terms of what they're learning. It's a huge way to stem the flow of the Russian military. And I think that's why they're stunned. They lost hundreds and hundreds of vehicles. I mean, how they're going to replace that, you know, I mean, eventually the Russian people are going to have to find out. The information war here will be great. I'm working to get a database of Russian telephone numbers and have everybody here send text messages to Russians with a few pictures or a few explanations and let them know what's going on. I think that has as good a chance as anything of actually stemming the tide there. Social media is the version of dropping leaflets now, and it's just any which way to do that. You know, for example, anybody run into, or even here, getting, you know, any Russians they might know to, you know, explain, you know, are you writing back to your relatives? Are you explaining to them what's going on? I would think most Russians are appalled by this. Here's something most Americans don't understand, because we don't necessarily live like that. If they have relatives in Ukraine, in Russia, those relatives can be put in jail for what they say here. And so that's why they don't want to put their relatives in a bad place. So at some point you have to blame the Russians and say, look, you can't be on your knees forever. You got to get up and, you know, speak for yourself. But that's another story. That's a history lesson in itself.
So obviously Putin said on more than one occasion since the beginning of this that the resulting sanctions are being considered a declaration of war.
Well, he's already at war, so I don't know what he's saying. I mean, you know, but you know what that tells me is that, I mean, it's really hurting. I think, and you know, he's miscalculated at every critical step of the way along, even in his whole tenure. And I think COVID, this isolation has had an impact on him because, I mean, he's at war. But I think he was, and I think his generals did. See, that's what happens when they're in isolation. They're all in their 70s. And we know, like, look at our leadership. They're in their 50s. You know, if you have leadership in your 70s, they're still thinking Cold War, you know, Soviet Union times. So what happened here was they told him, look what happened in 2014. We got into Crimea. We took the Donbass. The troops, I mean, they didn't even raise a stink in the, you know, about Crimea. The Ukrainians really didn't. And neither did the Western community. We went into Georgia in 2008. They didn't do anything. And so I went to Crimea. So he says, you know, we'll go into Kiev. It's going to be the same thing. They'll slap on a few sanctions on oligarchs. I'll reimburse them out of my fund. I literally think that's what he expected. I think he is shocked by the fact that the whole community, I mean, and with, you know, simple things, withdrawing McDonald's. You know, McDonald's has been there since 1990. Well, they were there actually even in the Cold War. I think when Gorbachev was there, they actually, and Pepsi came in, you know, when they were still, before the Soviet Union fell apart. These are huge things. For them to come out, I think ultimately the people are going to say, what the hell is going on? This isn't normal stuff. And so, yeah, to your point, I mean, he said, whoa, this is a declaration of war. What that tells me is he is stunned by exactly this reaction. And the question now is he will work to this to basically break up the Western coalition. If the Western coalition stays right, Macron doesn't always travel there trying to tell him what we can do, you know, in terms of making him happy. If the West stays together, this will be a victory for liberty and democracy and freedom. And I think that danger that we face now of a new world order may pass. But the lesson will be, if we don't pay attention to it, if we don't work at it, we don't earn it, we can lose it. And I think that's what our founding fathers said. This, you know, democracy is not a natural evolution of society. It's got to be worked on. And I think that's, we're being faced with that right now. And I'll tell you, if Zelensky comes out as a hero on this, I don't know who they have. They said there's a succession plan. They have, I'm not sure they worked all that out. But man, if he survives this, you know, he will be the Ukrainian George Washington. I can't tell you how many Ukrainians even told me when he was elected there would be the end of Ukraine. I said, I don't think so. I said, I think there's something here that he's going to do okay. And he has. So the requirements right now are just quick sort of survival things. Can you get, you know, either blankets, cots, tents, things like that for people at the borders? And, you know, the medicines are key. And then, you know, eventually the list will expand and more things will have. As a matter of fact, my colleague, you know, and part of my consulting group, he was in the Air Force and he did humanitarian missions in East Timor and in the Balkans. So he knows how this whole sort of thing works. And he's putting together even the medical kits that they need. You know, he's giving us a list of those. The outpouring in Ukraine has been absolutely stunning, absolutely stunning. In Poland and all that stuff. So I don't think this will end. I don't think Putin's already talking about peace talks, but I think that's a diversion. And I think he wants it on his terms. And I hope that's where the West stays together. He should be rewarded with 0 inches of Ukrainian territory for doing this. If he says, oh, I want a land bridge to Crimea, say no. I mean, these are the borders. You go back. And now you pay through a reconstruction fund for rebuilding Ukraine. Yep. This was completely needless. And millions of people now, families broken apart, children dead, orphaned. This is a tragedy on the order of the way World War II started. And in Europe now, after Everybody said never again. And leadership and the West deserves some of the blame. I mean, not the cause, because frankly, they had nothing. Well, but their actions or inactions over the last 20 years resulted in where we are now.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll change. The question is for how long? Not just for 3 months, but for the next 50 years, let's hope.